We're discussing the UW's sports infrastructure in the era of COVID under a new athletic director on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Chris McIntosh was named to the post in June, filling the shoes of legendary athletic director and football coach Barry Alvarez, who retired after being with the program 31 years. What do you want to ask the new athletic director? Should college athletes be paid? How should programs handle athlete protests? And what about gender equity and the standard of equality in the athletic program? It's 800-642-1234. Chris McIntosh was deputy athletic director starting in 2017. He took over as director on July 1. And as a UW student, he led the Badgers football team to 2 Rose Bowls, later played in the NFL for the Seattle Seahawks. Chris, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Great to be with you, Kate.
You've taken over during a pandemic. So what decisions weigh heavily on you in preparation for games and especially the football season?
Yeah, well, you know, it's been an interesting summer and fall, certainly since July 1. You know, we're far more optimistic and frankly grateful that we're able to continue with our seasons this year compared to where we were, you know, a year ago. We're in a much better place. We know so much more today than we did a year ago last fall, which was really tough on our student athletes, on our staff, and on our fans. And so we're thankful today that fans can attend our events. So far they've been going very well. Our student athletes have been participating in their sports and doing so, you know, with a relatively high rate of vaccination, and we feel really happy and actually quite proud of that.
What percentage of the football team and staff has been vaccinated against COVID?
As we sit here today, we're north of 90% of our players have been vaccinated, and I believe almost, if not 100%, almost 100% of our staff.
How often are athletes and staff tested for COVID? What are the protocols there?
Yeah, unvaccinated student athletes are tested twice per week. That's consistent with it's PCR testing, consistent with NC2A guidelines, and consistent with our campus protocol. And so, that's been working well so far.
You know, another Big Ten school, Penn State, announced this week that all faculty and staff need to be vaccinated due to President Biden's mandate. Would you support that requirement at the UW?
You know, I would support the decision of our leadership. You know, we are a unit within our, obviously within the university. Our student athletes are students first, and that's our approach, and that's been our priority. And if our leadership felt it were necessary, we would be supportive of that. But you know, we've been working in partnership with campus leadership for the last over a year and a half on the issue of COVID, and been in lockstep that entire time, and we will continue to do so.
And speaking of campus leadership, Chancellor Rebecca Blank announcing this week she'll leave UW-Madison at the end of the school year to become president of Northwestern. What impact do you think this will have on the UW?
Well, it will certainly represent significant change. You know, Chancellor Blank has been a fabulous leader for our university, and more specifically, from my perspective and that of our department, for athletics. She has become very involved in college athletics, both at the Big Ten level as the chair of the Council of Presidents and Chancellors, and also at the NC2A level as a member of the Board of Governors. And it's been really exciting and rewarding to work with her on, you know, some of the most significant issues that face college athletics right now. Her leadership in Madison will be missed. She's been, as I mentioned earlier, a great partner to work with when, you know, we're dealing with some of the challenges that we've been faced with, COVID as one example, just one of many, really. And so, you know, I'll miss her. I will say I'm very happy for her because she's happy about the opportunity that she's been presented with, and it's a great honor, but she'll leave a void, and I hope that the leadership role at UW-Madison is it's a fantastic university and position, and hopefully it attracts talented candidates.
If you're just joining us, we're in conversation with Chris McIntosh, the new athletic director of UW-Madison. What questions do you have for UW's athletic director? Do you follow Badgers football? What do you think of the season so far? 800-642-1234. Joseph in Manitowoc is with us with a question. Hi, Joseph. Go ahead.
Yeah, Chris, I was just wondering, as far as equity, if there's any opportunity or if you could speak directly to giving our baseball players in the state of Wisconsin an opportunity for something to look up to, get a scholarship opportunity that maybe even half of what all the football players get. I just have never understood why we would have gotten rid of a program like that when the rest of the Big Ten schools are there. And I'm hopeful and optimistic that you see the equity concerns there as far as giving kids an opportunity to look up to something other than a football program that's sustaining 21 different programs just on the finances of football.
Joseph, thank you. Chris, go ahead.
Yeah, Joseph, it's a great question, and it's one that I get quite often. It was 30 years ago that baseball along with a few other programs were discontinued during some really challenging financial times. And that's been well documented. The way I look at it or think about it going forward is first of all, I'm empathetic to those that have a great passion for that particular program. Certainly those that participated in it. We have many letter winners that I meet with and talk to that have a lot of passion for the baseball program and would like to see it returned. And I'm empathetic to their feelings around it. I have a hard time just as a former student athlete myself imagining what that must feel like. I think, the challenge we have today is, college athletics right now is at a inflection point. And there are so many issues that are being debated about college athletics. It's a time of significant instability. And our priority at the moment is to preserve and enhance the 23 sport programs that we have. That's not to say that we won't have more in the future. I'm not ruling that out, but at the moment, we need to focus on making sure that our 23 sport programs fit in a new world of college athletics with so many uncertainties on the horizon. So that's where our focus is today. But there's no telling where we might be in the future.
Well, in this new world, though, there is the legacy and the law, the civil rights law, Title IX, passed in 1972, requiring that men and women students have equitable opportunities to participate in sports. What more can the UW do to create opportunities, especially for women?
Yeah, I mean, Kate, you hit the nail on the head. We're about to celebrate the 50th year of Title IX, and really for us at Wisconsin and across the Big Ten, it's a celebration of broad-based opportunity. And Joseph, the caller, mentioned or made reference to, the financial model of our department and many, and that is, the opportunity for all, in our case, approximately 800 student athletes, largely underwritten by a football program, a distant second, a men's basketball program, and then men's hockey. And there's no secret that that is the financial model, but what's a priority for us is that opportunity for approximately, 150 other student athletes, men and women in sports that don't generate a surplus of revenue have an opportunity to gain an education at a world-class institution like Wisconsin while participating in their sport and competing at or aspiring to compete at a championship level. And that's what we've focused on. We think that's important, broad-based opportunity, certainly equitable broad-based opportunity. And I think that's one of the aspects of college athletics that has the potential to get lost in this debate as we go forward about what college athletics should be and what it, where it should go. And I think we're doing everything we can to fight for that.
Let's pause right there with UW Athletic Director Chris McIntosh. Stepped into the job July 1st. Do you think that college athletes are treated fairly? Do men's sports get too much attention? How have you been watching the athletic program? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Chris McIntosh here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing the UW's athletic program with its new athletic director. Chris McIntosh is here on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Looking at the conferences in NCAA Division I, in recent months, we saw Texas and Oklahoma announce their programs are transitioning from the Big 12 to the SEC. What does that move mean for the Big 10? Are you watching that? Should it expand? 800-642-1234. Athletic Director Chris McIntosh stays with us for 10 more minutes. So, Chris, the Southeastern Conference, the SEC, announces this summer that Texas and Oklahoma will be joining that. What effect could this have on college athletics and your division?
Yeah, Kate, it's a great question. I think, you know, that move is an indicator of, or one of a few indicators of just the dramatic change that is taking place in college athletics. I think it, you know, it provides an opportunity for conferences to be vocal about what they stand for and what they believe in, what college athletics should be about. And I think that's what the Big Ten has done as a result of some of the narrative and discussion about expansion. As you know, the Big Ten entered into an alliance with the ACC and the Pac-12, and you know, there will be operational or logistical opportunities there, scheduling opportunities. But I think as much as anything, it was about standing shoulder to shoulder with two other conferences that have a shared belief system, a shared priority that education should be at the primacy of what we do. And I think it's got the potential to be pretty special going forward.
Yeah, I mean, shared beliefs are one thing, but there's a ton of money on the line with television revenue and ad revenue. And one benefit of the move for the SEC is the potential for more revenue for televised games. But I was looking at, you know, according to the AP, the Big Ten produced the most in revenue in 2020, and is exploring extensions with Fox and ESPN. What do you make of those moves in light of the money made from TV?
Well, I can speak to, you know, our own department and our own model. As I mentioned, you know, earlier, you know, the model for us is that the cost of opportunity for 23 sports is borne by, you know, the revenue that's generated out of a few sports and there's no secret about that. Our financials are pretty transparent, and certainly when we had challenges like COVID, in which we weren't able to, you know, fill Camp Randall for games on Saturday, it became apparent. And so, you know, the Big Ten, as you mentioned, does benefit from a strong media partnership with Fox, and there are discussions taking place about what the future might look like for us, but that those funds, those revenues are the means of underwriting opportunity, educational and athletic opportunity for, like I mentioned, approximately 650 other student athletes in 20 sports that don't generate, you know, a financial surplus in their sport.
Well, let's take another call now. Warren is joining us from Menominee County. Hi, Warren. What's on your mind?
Good morning. I was wondering if we ever see a day where a female will have a prominent role in a college football game or eventually an NFL game.
So, and it was a little hard to hear, but when a female would have a prominent role in a football program, Warren was asking.
Yeah, Warren, I'm left to speculate a little bit about, you know, what role you might be referring to. But I will say this, you know, there wouldn't be anything preventing today a female from having a prominent role on our staff. There are certainly opportunities and you know, in our game last week in Illinois, you may have noticed there was a female who had a prominent role on the officiating crew. And I think you're seeing more and more of that. I think it's pretty exciting. I know it's something that we obviously would certainly be open to, and nothing preventing that. There is a need for more women to get exposed to and to get involved in the sport of football.
Along those lines, the language of your contract states that you need to promote gender and racial equity throughout the athletic program. And that's a revision from Barry Alvarez's contract language that just called out gender equity. What are you doing to advance racial equity under your leadership?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think, you know, we have spent a lot of time and energy with that as a focus. And, you know, you mentioned that you know, my contract reads differently than Barry's had historically. And I think that's just a sign of how far we've come and where our priorities are today, given the times we live in today. And we have spent a lot of time focusing on racial equity and social justice over the last few years. We are hiring. We've changed our approach in recruitment of staff to try to create more diverse pools of candidates. We've created and released our strategic plan. We are building out and making hires on our DEI team. And I think you're seeing some exciting opportunities around campus that focus on, you know, attracting and retaining people of color in and around not just the athletic department, but around campus. And so I'm pretty excited about where we've come, and I'm really excited about the connections that we've made with community leaders and partnerships around Madison, but not limited to that. I think will be productive going forward.
We're talking with Chris McIntosh, Athletic Director, UW-Madison. Let's land here, Chris, on the push for colleges to pay student athletes. You know, college sports is a $14 billion industry. Why shouldn't athletes get paid for rights to their name, image, and likeness?
Well, I don't think there's debate over the ability for athletes to collect revenue around their name, image, and likeness. And that was one of the big developments of this past summer. And that's happening today. As of July 1, that's permissible. We developed our own policy consistent with the direction that the NCAA gave us. And as you know, we're in a state that does not have a state law on NIL. And that allowed us the flexibility to develop a policy that, that we've been working with our student athletes on. And I think we're in a good spot. I think our student athletes are happy with the ability that they now have to go to the marketplace and to, if they choose, you know, capture opportunity around their use of their name and likeness. And so far it's been pretty exciting. I think we've had many of our student athletes take advantage of it. But you know, that development itself, name, image, and likeness, doesn't require student athletes to have an employment status as an employee. It allows them to preserve their status as a student.
And how do you feel about the employment status? Should athletes be paid?
I think our student athletes are students, and they're students first. They come to the university as students, and they participate in sport, and they pursue their passion of sport. But for decades now, our priority has been, when we're recruiting student athletes, is to graduate with a degree from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And I think that's a model that is certainly evolving. And I think there are plenty of opportunities, like name, image, and likeness, that we've seen this summer, for it to be enhanced. But I don't think that it requires them to be employees.
Chris, thank you for joining us.
Happy to. Thank you.
Chris McIntosh, Athletic Director at UW-Madison. WPR is a service of UW-Madison. Stay with us. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. The reigning champions, the Milwaukee Bucks, tip off their new regular season next week. And to celebrate, here's producer Brad Kohlberg talking with the author of a biography on Milwaukee Bucks superstar Giannis Antetokounmpo.
The Milwaukee Bucks are NBA champions for the first time in 50 years.
It's over. The Bucks have done it. The long wait has ended. After a half century, the Milwaukee Bucks are NBA champions once again.
And Giannis Antetokounmpo is the superstar at the heart of the team. Not only does he have a national championship and two MVP trophies under his belt, but there's also a new biography on him. I recently talked with the author of Giannis, The Improbable Rise of an NBA MVP. It's about Antetokounmpo's Greek upbringing and his journey to American basketball stardom.
My name is Miran Fader, and I'm a staff writer at The Ringer.
Fader says Antetokounmpo was born in Sepolia, a neighborhood of Athens, Greece. She says life was tough. His parents had migrated from Nigeria, and they were undocumented, so finding work was hard.
So the parents would then bring the kids to sell items on the street or at upscale beaches and try to do whatever they could to put food on the table. And, you know, oftentimes they just wouldn't eat. So it was really, really tough. However, there was a lot of joy as well.
Antetokounmpo started playing basketball at age 13. He couldn't play on the elite local teams because of his immigration status, but some NBA scouts started to take notice anyway. By 2013, an 18-year-old Antetokounmpo was a scrawny but intriguing outsider as the NBA draft approached.
So the Milwaukee Bucks are choosing at number 15, and they decide to take a swing because it's Milwaukee.
With the 15th pick in the 2013 NBA draft, the Milwaukee Bucks select Giannis Antetokounmpo.
And you hope to get lucky, but you expect disappointment. You don't know if this Greek kid is going to work out, but he's really tall and he's charismatic, and maybe he might be okay.
Antetokounmpo ended up being more than just okay, and Milwaukee was a great fit because the team allowed him time to get acclimated to life in the NBA and the U.S.
And not having the pressure of coming in, being deified as the superstar, enabled him to grow. The only pressure that Giannis felt was, how do I provide money for my family? How do I get my family to come to America? You know, his pressures were different than the average NBA rookie.
Fader says taking care of his family was so important to Antetokounmpo because of how tight-knit they had always been.
Giannis grew up watching how his dad would pretend he wasn't hungry and give his portions to his sons. And Giannis's brothers were his best friends, his comrades. They were always laughing. They always shared everything. There was no arguments because everything was communal.
The love that Antetokounmpo had for his family was on display in 2019 when he got emotional while accepting his first MVP award. He also thanked his teammates that night and the city of Milwaukee.
And I think the thing that endears fans to Giannis most and Giannis to this city is that these fans watched him grow up. They liked that he wasn't crowned king at age 13. And they liked that this came out of nowhere. That's the ultimate lesson of all from people that come from Milwaukee. You work hard and dream big. And Giannis has done that.
And now Antetokounmpo has two MVPs and a championship. And he's signed a contract extension, so his future is in Milwaukee. So what does Fader think that future might look like?
Keep in mind, Giannis is 26 years old, and he is just beginning to mature, not just into a global basketball superstar, but into a man, a father. And I think we're going to see him use his platform and his voice in bigger ways beyond the basketball court. I think Giannis is primed to become more. I think he's going to share more of himself.
Miran Fader is a staff writer at The Ringer and the author of Giannis, The Improbable Rise of an NBA MVP. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
And now the pandemic has taken a heavy toll on many rural communities, rural healthcare systems strained by fewer hospitals, a shortage of nurses, and other health specialties spread thin. The state health department announced multiple funding opportunities Wednesday to address COVID health disparities, including $9 million dedicated to rural communities. Are you a farmer or a migrant worker? Where do you get your health care? It's 800-642-1234. Laura Waldvogel is CEO of Family Health La Clinica, a community health care system serving rural patients in a 10-county area of central Wisconsin. Laura, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you. I'm very excited to be here this morning.
Well, explain first La Clinica, how it operates and how it operates within the structure of community health centers in central Wisconsin.
Yeah, so Family Health La Clinica is a community health center in Wisconsin, and we serve the rural central heart of Wisconsin for the community health needs. And then we also serve the entire state of Wisconsin as the only migrant health center in Wisconsin. And we receive federal funding to assist us in our efforts to support those who lack access to health care.
So the only migrant health center, what services are you offering?
We offer primary medical, dental, and behavioral health services. We have 5 locations and a mobile unit. We also offer WIC services and recovery services for those who struggle with substance abuse disorders.
We have heard so much about not being able to get mental health care in rural areas. What are you seeing on the ground?
Yes, we are seeing that. In the past several years, we actually added behavioral health to our service array. And shortly after that, we offered a pretty comprehensive program for recovery services for opioid use disorder. During the pandemic, we have definitely seen an uptick in need for behavioral health services. And currently, we offer those services in 2 locations, here in Wautoma and also in Friendship, with plans to expand behavioral health and recovery services into Stevens Point and Beaver Dam, as well as our mobile unit.
And how are you reaching patients? We've heard a lot about teleconferencing and the ability to see patients, by Zoom and other phone connections. How has that been going?
Yes. So this has been an incredible year, a very taxing year for everyone in healthcare and everyone around the globe, period. For us, it afforded us the opportunity to really use our mobile services. So depending upon who we are serving, we use our outreach services to adapt to the needs of those we're serving. So I just want to talk a little bit about migrant health for a bit. So migrant and seasonal farm workers in Wisconsin have particular and unique vulnerabilities to the virus in that they live and work in conditions that tend to help spread the virus. So early on in the pandemic, we had our chief medical officer very, very interested in developing a risk mitigation strategy to address the unique needs of migrant and seasonal ag workers in the state. So that included, it seems like a lifetime ago, but that included education, worksite assessments, testing. It's hard to remember, but back in the beginning of all of this, testing was not something that you had easy access to. So we really pushed hard for the migrant and seasonal ag worker community to have access to testing so that we could mitigate the risk of spread, take care of them, their employers, the communities that they're in, and protect the food supply.
So as you look at risk management there, is there enough testing in rural communities and especially in rural businesses that do have a clustered number of people working together?
I can only speak to what I know, which is my own system and my own arena, and the answer to that is yes. We have been very fortunate to be able to test and have access to testing and vaccination for those that we're serving. The state of Wisconsin has been an incredible partner to us and other systems within the state to ensure access to testing and vaccination. We've also had the support of the federal government as well, as have others.
What about education around the vaccine, messaging on the vaccine, and your patients being able to ask these really vital questions and being able to trust the vaccine?
Yeah, so here at Family Health La Clinica, we provide education services in a language that meets the needs of the farm workers. So that's English and Spanish. And for our patients that are not Spanish speaking or maybe have a different language, we will provide that in English or whatever the language is. But we are ready, willing, and able to provide information and education to those who desire it. We make sure that we are going to outreach events. We've gone to multiple sites throughout the state at different county fairs and festivals and different events just to ensure that people have access to accurate information. The most intense outreach we have done, however, has been with the migrant and seasonal ag worker population, because that's a big part of our mission.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The cost of insulin, the cost of prescription meds can be so high for people. How do you approach that medications with your patients and making sure that they are able to stay on these meds and bring those costs down?
It's a really great question. The one thing that I will say about community health centers, ours and others, is that our job is to ensure that barriers to positive health outcomes are addressed. And one of the biggest barriers, of course, can be access to medications. So we do that in a number of ways. We have access to what's called the 340B drug pricing program, which does tend to decrease the cost of medications for those who are uninsured. We also work with patient assistance programs through the drug companies to ensure that patients have access to those programs and can get either decreased cost or free medications. We just work very diligently to ensure that our patients have access to the medications that they need.
We have Family Health La Clinica CEO Laura Waldvogel, who's with us on the challenges of delivering quality healthcare to rural Wisconsin communities. Do you work in rural healthcare? What is your experience like? What is your patient load? Do people recognize you as a physician or a medical provider when you're out and about at the grocery store? What are those conversations like? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Laura Waldvogel here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. DHS, Department of Health Services, announced a new grant program this week called Mobilizing Communities for a Just Response. It's $3 million directed at agencies located in rural areas or serving rural communities to advance equity and remove barriers to healthcare. What barrier have you encountered seeing a dentist or scheduling a session with a mental health provider? How is COVID affecting the rural community where you live? Where do you see gaps? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Laura Waldvogel is CEO of Family Health La Clinica with a center in Wautoma, four other locations as well, with us for about nine more minutes. Laura, we've seen a stream of federal pandemic aid coming down. What impact are these grants having on your operations and what you can deliver?
Well, it was, it made the difference as to whether or not we could stay functional. During the pandemic, Family Health La Clinica was definitely significantly impacted, just as other health systems were. For us, as a federally qualified health center who devoted a tremendous amount of resources into expanding access to dental services, it really hit us hard because dental was impacted incredibly during the pandemic in terms of shutdown. So having access to support to allow us to keep our doors open and lights on and be available to patients who had need for emergency care, because that's all we could deliver for dental for a while, it just made all of the difference. And we were able to take care of our workforce and keep them employed while we worked to get the things in place that we needed to reopen.
Yeah. And as for these recent grants that you're seeing, do they align with what you do? Are you going after them? How does that work?
Yes, absolutely. We are going after funding sources that allow us to continue to reach those who need us most. So that means expanding access in areas where there is need, but there perhaps aren't the services. For example, as I mentioned earlier, Stevens Point and Beaver Dam, where we are located now with dental-only services and intend to expand to provide behavioral health and primary medical services as well. So we are definitely going after funding that will support our mission and our ability to serve those who need us most.
We're talking with Laura Waldvogel, CEO for Family Health La Clinica, operating health clinics in Stevens Point, as she mentioned, Mauston, Wautoma, other rural areas of central Wisconsin. You can join in, 800-642-1234. Let's go to Charles in Wausau. Hi, Charles. What is your story?
Good morning. I just wanted to share that I grew up in rural Wisconsin, Fall Creek, if anybody's familiar. And I'm going to medical school in the Medical College of Wisconsin on one of their satellite campuses in Wausau. And the whole campus is, the purpose of it is to bring rural students from Wisconsin and educate them to become medical doctors because they are the most likely population to return to rural Wisconsin. And through my medical experiences before medical school, I've had lots of contact with community health clinics and FQHC, federally qualified health centers. And as a prospective physician, I really, really hate the United States insurance system. And so working for community health clinics, I think, is just one step that I can take to make it better for all of us in Wisconsin, especially because there's so much poverty in rural Wisconsin.
Charles, do you envision yourself practicing, setting up your practice in a rural area?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Another, and just while we have you on the line, another big issue, of course, is specialties and specialties gravitating to much larger population bases and the need for general practice, but still those specialties in rural areas. How do you talk about that in med school?
The Medical College of Wisconsin definitely tries to keep an open door for whatever kind of specialty you're interested in.
Mm-hmm.
Down in Milwaukee, they have much more services if you want to highly specialize. Up here in Wausau, they don't necessarily push you towards primary care, but that's, you know, what they always say that rural Wisconsin needs. But they definitely say, you know, if you're interested in a more specialized field, you can definitely do it. We will help you with that.
Charles, thank you for your story. Laura, what would you like to say in terms of Charles and medical school and his vision in a rural area?
Well, thank you. We are very strong partners with a Medical College of Wisconsin. We have a couple of their students doing projects with us. We would love to talk with you if you're interested in the future in working with rural health, with an excellent organization, Charles, but really just thank you for your dedication to rural healthcare. It is, it's where it's at, in my opinion. Federally qualified health centers is where it's at. We are just a collaborative group and really very, very mission driven. And it's the heart of healthcare.
I want to go back to your mobile unit. Can you explain how this mobile unit operates and what that looks like?
Yeah, so we have a new mobile unit. In the past, we've had trailers, we've had renovated like Winnebagos and things like that. In 2019, we bought a new mobile unit, 40 foot, that can do medical, primary medical or dental services. We literally travel the state delivering those services to migrant seasonal farm workers, as well as other vulnerable populations. For example, before the pandemic, we used our mobile unit to reach the Amish community to provide dental services, and that had to be paused, but it's going to be resurrected soon. So we have a team of just incredibly dedicated workers that go out. We also have residents that travel with us, and temporary providers and others that are deeply interested in ensuring that migrant and seasonal farm workers have access to primary care. And of course, the past year and a half or so, access to risk mitigation from COVID-19, whether it be testing or vaccinations.
It's really interesting how you've put such a focus on dental care and putting a fair amount of this work in your organization into dental. Why is that so important? What are you seeing there as a gap?
There are significant gaps for those who are uninsured, underinsured, or use Medicaid to access dental and behavioral health services for that matter. So community health centers like Family Health La Clinica, and in particular Family Health La Clinica, have seen that and greatly invested in dental. So we currently have four of our five locations plus our mobile unit that can deliver dental. And it's not just those who are uninsured and underinsured or use Medicaid. You know, access to dental services is a real issue in rural Wisconsin for everyone.
Mm. Yeah. Very quickly, what is the future of community health? Where do you see it headed?
I see that there are significant opportunities for us to continue to meet the need of those who have access issues. And I see in Wisconsin and across the nation, community health centers, you know, picking up that directive, that need, and running with it and expanding access. There's a deep commitment by the volunteer boards, 51% of whom must be patients of health centers, to really ensure that access is afforded to all, regardless of ability to pay.
Laura, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for your interest in federally qualified community health centers.
Laura Waldvogel, CEO of Family Health La Clinica, which operates health clinics in Stevens Point, Mauston, Wautoma, other rural areas of central Wisconsin. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.